So today I'm really happy to welcome on the podcast co-founder of ZK Lend, Brian Fu. Welcome, Brian. To have you on. So high level, ZK Lend is a permissionless money market protocol natively built on Starknet, combining ZK rollup scalability, superior transaction speed and cost savings with Ethereum's security. And the reason why we've got you on the show is you really are a very early pioneer in the world of ZK, at least in the context of Web3. ZK is an area that we're really interested in. Outlier, recently launching one of our programs early last year, first ZK dedicated ZK accelerator program, and now in the middle of our second program, and you're kind of regarded as an OG in the space. And obviously ZK is much hyped, a lot of promise and potential about it. Some people kind of say it promises the end game for Web3, privacy by default, but it's very technical, it's very complex, it's very difficult to understand what's actually possible today, what are limitations, but you are somebody that's applying this technology day in, day out. And I believe ZK Lend and many of your kind of core team, your CTO, are core contributors to the wider ecosystem, the Starknet ecosystem, its libraries and everything else. So if anybody's going to be able to help us navigate the space, it's you. Some high level stats on ZK. So at the time of recording, which is 8th of March, 24, TVL of about $5 million, total borrowing of nine, just under 140,000 monthly active. So some really good kind of traction and momentum there. Maybe before we get into what is ZK and have you help us navigate the kind of the technology, the stack, and then its potential, maybe we could get a little bit more about your background, Brian.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Jamie, for it. Thanks for having me on. Brian, I'm co-founder of ZK Lend. So my background was a banker to begin with. I started my career in banking, investment banking, did that for about 7 years, cover mainly public transactions in the real estate space. After 7 years, I moved on to doing private equity, basically flipping side of the table and then being the investor side, and then being, instead of the lender, being the borrower. Did that for about 7 years again. And so within my 14, 10 years in the TriFi space, I've done quite a fair bit of public loans, private loans, and have been on both sides of the table, having looked at numbers of loan agreements. So this is something that I'm quite comfortable and quite well-versed in, so to speak. So that's kind of my background coming in before getting rabbit hole into the crypto space. Would love to discuss a little bit more about how I got dragged in. It was, I would say, around 2016-ish onwards. I've always been looking into the crypto space already, but only as a basically investor, is looking at meme coins, shit coins, and basically anything that pops up and people talk about on Twitter. I would follow it. I would try to buy a little bit just to see how it apes. And then starting to see a lot of institutions, while they are, especially financial institutions, while they're on service, not really supportive, not having a very supportive stance, but deep down, they're doing a lot of blockchain work. They're doing a lot of integrations and they're exploring and researching on their own. So my sense is that definitely that there is something to it. It's not going away. And it's basically going to, if not replaced, it's going to augment the whole financial experience. So for me, I really want to get myself involved. And lucky enough, I have a friend working in this space, and he connected me with two other co-founders, Jonathan and Jane. The three of us got together, and we brainstormed for a whole 2 months. Sounds very short, but it's actually very long in terms of crypto space. The whole narrative could have moved already. We have moved. We wanted to build on Solana at first, but then we eventually chose Starknet and building on top of Ethereum. So that's kind of the background, how I got from my TriFi background all the way into starting a company, starting a lending protocol on Starknet.
And so I believe you personally made the move full-time into crypto 21 and Starknet was early 2022. As you said, you were kind of moonlighting really as a degen, I guess, you know, putting on the suit, going doing the TradFi job in the day and then moonlighting in the evening, presumably. And it's interesting you say there's kind of this disconnect between like public face, at least then anyway, this kind of public facing stance of financial institutions towards crypto and then what's actually going on underneath the bonnet, not just with the degenning in the spare time, but institutional R&D and everything else. So maybe kind of before we get to start there, it'd be good to understand, you know, your perspective. Why in 21 did you decide to make that move? At the time, did it feel risky? And, you know, what are you now seeing in the wider institutional world? Are you seeing more of your peers move over to the space and into DeFi?
Absolutely risky. I would say when I tell my friends, a lot of them would be looking at me weirdly saying, like, you have a good job in TriFi, and it's not like something that you just want to throw it away and then try something new. But why 2021? It's not specifically the year itself, but it's more so I just had the opportunity to meet up with my co-founders, and then I wasn't sure for a fair amount of time before really get myself comfortable, because at the time we wanted to build a DeFi protocol, and I was thinking, well, maybe I can hop in as a kind of an advisor role because of my TriFi background, and then I would still be kind of wearing dual hats. But it's just not possible, because once you really wanted to get off the ground, you want to do fundraising, you want to do it full time with basically all the resources you have into it. And the narrative for Layer 2 started to pick up, and we felt that it's not so. I think there are quite a number of reasons adding together. You mentioned about how the institutions are basically they're exploring the blockchain technology already, and my stance on it, it's instead of looking through a TriFi lens into the DeFi world, which is going to be all messed up and it's not the right way to look at it. I mean, that's my personal opinion. Why not just dive in and then get the first-hand experience? I mean, if you get nothing out of it, at least you get the experience and get the first-hand learning from working in the DeFi space, working in the Web3 space, and then you can take this learning and whatever you go afterwards, whether that be quasi-institutional, that would still be something of a hands up for you. That's one. And then two, it's, I mean, I got really convinced to the whole Layer 2 narrative, and then I just really wanted to take off. I do see there is a way for it to go forward. And so, yeah, just want to take the risk and then making it big. Hopefully that's going to be come to reality. But if not, I think I'm enjoying the journey any minute right now.
Well, look, as I said at the top end, you've got some great momentum. I think, you know, you just said that from your perspective, it's not coming into DeFi and Web3 with a TradFi perspective, trying to presumably just recreate, replicate what's already there. Why do you think that doesn't work? Why do you think you need to come at it? I guess, is it from a fresh perspective, you know, from a native perspective? How do you look at that?
Yep. I think a lot of what we see currently in the DeFi space, it's a recreation or a reconcept of what's already working in TriFi space, so to speak. There are products like lending, which has been there for forever in the TriFi space. And you would see the qualities of, for example, perps trading for derivative, let's say. But what I meant by having to basically look at DeFi, standing in the crypto space, not a institutional play space, is because one, if you have to consider a lot of the value creation in terms of what crypto is, it really doesn't make sense to a lot of the institutions. And when you don't have that initial convictions, it's never going to get off. So a lot of what we create, you can say that, for example, let's say Bitcoin, Ethereum, I mean, there are limiting noises now, but there were many, many people talking about, does it actually worth anything? Back 5 years ago, 6 years ago. But right now we see that there are ETFs stricter around it. So the value, it's starting to solidify. But I think a lot of narratives, it seems to be very wild, far-fetched and very wildly structured together if you look at it from a very traditional sense. But it's just how a whole new industry is going to get evolved from it. Like, for example, staking, it's a new concept that you don't see anywhere else. But because of staking, you can have new concepts where it's similar to derivative, but then you apply it on top and create a financial vehicle for that. So I do see that it's an amalgamation of like traditional finance, but you have to really take off that TriFi hat and be able to see the way forward.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess unless you have a kind of fundamental grasp of Web3 and its primitives, then it doesn't make sense, right? And you can't retrofit kind of a TradFi perspective on it. That's interesting. So you mentioned that, I mean, it's natural that you come into DeFi, right? Given your background, you said that the Layer 2 narrative was something that led you to kind of think about ZK Lend. And so could you maybe just talk about the Layer 2 narrative, why you think that's important and led to ZK Lend?
Sure. I mean, once we have to understand the purpose of using DeFi or using Web3, it's that it's presumably permissionless, trustless, and you have the blockchain technology being applied to it where your data and your value is being secured by all the other validators on chain. And in order to do that, you need decentralization. I think that's going to be one thing that's quite critical for the whole blockchain ethos. And for us choosing the one that is most decentralized, Ethereum is definitely the top choice for us. And we felt that going forward, you cannot have a more decentralized network being sprung up without any downtime at all. So Ethereum was the top choice for us. And we have all experienced, I mean, the whole DeFi summer, how gas price, I mean, even right now, you see gas price going up to $30, $50 for a transaction of $10. That doesn't really make sense. And that's why Ethereum, it's not good per se for a lot of the very basic transfer swaps and whatnot or DeFi narratives. So that's why I think layer two really helps solve the problem in terms of this, the scalability. I mean, at the time that I joined, there were a lot of layer two's optionality already. For example, there were Optimism, Arbitrum for fault proof, and then for even for CK proof, there are a few choices too. And at the time we felt that CK proof, it's definitely going to be the top choice because you are eventually looking into something that would not need a trust assumptions. And I think that's going to be the ethos of blockchain and using it so that you are actually trusting the code, trusting the math, and not how a group of people behave and hoping that everyone would behave the right way and then having the integrity.
So maybe let's talk about ZK and ZK rollups. So did you start with a particular use case and then work backwards from that? Or were you actually looking specifically at the use cases that could be applied through ZK technology? What was your direction of innovation?
I think it's actually coming from both end, and we kind of meet in the middle. So we know that layer two is something that it's quite interesting. ZK technology is something that it's definitely going to take over a lot of the volume, a lot of the liquidity. But a lot of the ZK technologies were being used primarily from a SaaS perspective and then for DEX and high volume transactions. And for a lending protocol, it's actually not the top choice that they would actually refer to a ZK platform because it's just not high volume enough. But because, I mean, the mix of the experience that we have, and ultimately we came to the conclusion that, okay, for us, we want to do a lending protocol that it's very straightforward, very fundamental. It's going to be a sustainable business, so then it doesn't really ride on a lot of hype, doesn't ride on, for example, new farming, or let's say, for example, RST at the moment, where the narrative could be very, very strong for a very short period of time, and then it could die down quickly. So we want something that's sustainable and could be applied to both retail and eventually institution as well. With that, I think lending is definitely the Lego piece that we felt it's going to be, you can be a foundation and it can also be a piece that help build on other narrative as well. So that is why we decided to build a lending protocol. And in terms of the platform for building it, StartNet came out to be the top choice for ZK rollup because of several reasons that I'm happy to expand a little bit more later on.
Yeah, so let's go there. Let's understand that choice because, you know, big area for us when we're working with founders is kind of making technical decisions, and they all have trade-offs, right? And often you're building on the fly, especially if you're still trying to find product market fit. You don't necessarily know what the end product is, or, you know, there's plenty of different pathways that you could take. One of the challenges for a lot of Web3 founders, I mean, there are several, you know, there's regulatory risk, there's business model risk, but there's technical risk. Why StartNet? What led you to make that design choice?
Sure. I think StartNet for us, it feels too good to be true because when we looking at ZK rollup landscape, at the time, there were two main ones. There were ZK Sync and also StartNet that has been working towards an alpha mainnet. And then there was Grow that's still in testnet, and then a few others as well. But comparing between the two top contenders, StartNet, they have been running with the StartX engines for a very long time already. So basically, the StartX, they have, just to backtrack a little bit, because StartNet itself, it's a layer two network, which is developed by Startware. And Startware is the company that developed both StartNet and also StartX. And StartX, it's the SaaS component or SaaS business that actually helps a lot of the protocol to achieve scalability. So some of the protocol that actually use StartX would be DYDX, Soulware, Immutable, where they have a lot of high trading volume, high sales volume. and they can achieve a customized layer 2 for these type of protocol. Obviously, they will charge a fee for that. And for us, looking at StartNet, when the whole idea came up, is that you will build on StartNet, you don't have to pay a fee. It's interoperable layer where every protocol built on StartNet would be able to communicate with each other, and you would be able to enjoy the security of Ethereum. So that basically solves two things for us. It's robust. We have seen the track record of 600 million transactions being transacted on StartNet. So it's not something that's experimental. That's one. And then two, it's there's the Ethereum security that's embedded directly already. And then on top of that, because Start, they actually use Starkproof. The Starkproof, it's slightly different from the Snarkproof that a lot of the other, it's a little bit technical here. I am not the one that's actually 100%.
Don't worry, me neither.
Yeah, so on this front, the Starkproof, basically they differ from the Snarkproof such that there's no trust setting. It's more succinct, and then it's quantum resistance. You won't be able to theoretically hack it with a quantum computer down in the future. So they call it future-proof. But for layman like me, I would just call it basically it's fast, it's trustless, the technology that will not break even down in the future. I think these are kind of the three core reasons. And then I think once we hop onto the ecosystem and we just found the developer ecosystem, it's just very eager and everyone is trying to build things really fast, trying to build new infrastructure. And we really enjoyed it because there must be other community that's very, very vibrant as well. But I would see from firsthand that the ecosystem for starting developers, they're just very talented. They have a very specific purpose and specific vision they want to achieve coming into StartNet. And everyone is just bringing different insights and creating a new perspective of looking at things. Because if you are just bringing up another EVM sidechains or EVM layer 2, you would start to see a lot of the bigger blue chips protocol just come on board. And then basically it's a replication of the Ethereum network itself. But you don't see that on StartNet because StartNet actually programs in language that it's proprietary to them. It's called Cairo. So the Cairo language itself is specifically designed for ZK circuit. So it doesn't have a lot of the incumbents that Solidity has. So which is something that's going to be a con for a lot of developers onboarding. It's getting better now, but it's a lot of pros when you basically develop ZK contracts and then it just runs a lot smoothly and then you don't have to have a lot of custom bytecodes and custom libraries in order for your protocol to work with others.
Okay, yeah, so that's very cool. I mean, as you say, and all technologies have this pros and cons, right? But it gives you some defensibility. Ultimately, it's a barrier to entry, but it gives you some defensibility as well, which is obviously a challenge in context of DeFi more generally. So then let's talk more specifically about ZK Lend. So what does this kind of, these primitives enable ZK Lend to do today?
Yep. I would say for the current version of ZKLend, it's still very, very bread and butter. We support permissionless lending. It's over-collateralized. You can pledge one asset and then you will be able to borrow the other. And the difference that we have, it's basically we're live on StartNet. So we leverage a lot of the ZK technologies that actually enable the speed. It's definitely a lot faster. Transaction cost, it's better than Ethereum and a number of other layer twos. But on top of that, other great features are, for example, for wallets on StartNet. They're all smart contract wallets. So right now, it's not being explored to very fine details just yet, but you start to see narrative where you would be able to do multi-calls. Basically, what it means is a lot of different transactions. For example, when you approve transactions on Ethereum, you have to approve, and then you have to set your limits, and then you would have to sign a transaction. You have to sign it three times. So what happens on StartNet is they're able to use the same security and then being able to string all these transactions together into one single transaction. It doesn't seem very revolutionary at the moment right now, but imagine if you start to do multiple transactions between different protocols. And then if you want to, for example, because I think for ZKLend, we want to be a base layer that enables a lot of modularity to build on top. So lending, I think it's still very basics. But if you, for example, you can add on vault strategies on top, or you can add on other trading strategies on top, and then you basically link with all the other protocol on-chain, and being able to sign one single transaction to see what kind of cost you have for doing this one loop, whether your transaction would be successful, and then you will be able to do this with one single press of a button, I think it starts to become a lot more interesting. So ultimately, what we want to do is we want to create this large enough of a lending protocol that it's very modular. And then so that's why we have different features coming up, for example, isolated pools, transaction builders that actually help builders to basically incorporate and edit on top of what we have, and then being able to use this on both front end as a retail user or as a back end from builder point of view.
Very cool. Yeah. And I know you've got a very ambitious roadmap. I think a lot of that's been communicated that you're working through. So if we kind of zoom out a little bit now, obviously there's a lot of new innovations coming into the space almost, you know, every month now. It's really exciting generally in the ZK space. We've got many different partners. How, as a founding team, do you navigate that? So on the one hand, you know, you've kind of committed to this technology stack and an ecosystem, you know, you're active participants in it. On the other hand, there's lots of other stuff kind of coming at you. How do you manage the rate of innovation whilst trying to stay focused to the product and a technical roadmap?
I think we would be more leaning towards the slow side, to be completely honest and frank. The reason being is because I think we set out a very strong belief that we want to be sustainable. And sustainable is a very hard to define word, especially in crypto, because it encompasses a lot of concepts. Your protocol won't get exploited, won't get hacked. Security is one of them. If you get hacked, you won't last and you won't be sustainable. And two, it's basically your business model. It's not based on hype. Because of those two, we have been adding features and bringing on new innovations at a relatively slower speed because we want to make sure that at every point in time, the risk is being assessed accordingly. That's one. And I think having said that, we're still adding new innovations in terms of, for example, when staking came on last year for, let's say, for Lido, for liquid staking and so forth, we saw that different protocols have been trying to access this kind of yield and bringing it onto their protocol. And we also see that another partner of ours, the Bravo Wallets, they have been doing DeFi pooling to get this type of tokens onto Startnet, but there weren't too much usage of it. So at the time, we decided that we would open a market for these type of LST and being able to, basically for people to get the yield and deposit this type of LST and be able to use it to borrow against other assets. So being able to create more capital efficiency out of the assets that they have. I think right now we're still, only touching the surface of like what kind of narrative will evolve from, let's say, a staking point of view, restaking point of view, yield point of view. But I think all these, sometimes it just comes back to the very fundamental principle that people want to borrow because very, very fundamental reasons. They might want to short because they see what an asset is overvalued. They might want to basically leverage on the assets to buy another asset that's undervalued, or they want to create yield on their assets. So that's why we want to just make sure that we create a very good user experience to do those three things very well before we actually add on top. And I think for us, the roadmap for this year and next year, it's going to be really honing the modularity and the omni-chain component. So then we're able to get more protocol to use us and more liquidity passed through us and being able to enable more innovations this way.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting hearing your approach to kind of just do the fundamentals well and to do it in a way that you can build greater trust with the community, right? And be more cautious in the innovation. So if we kind of look more generally outside, it could be within DeFi, it could be much broader than that, but you know, looking forward over the next 3 years, I've got a kind of couple of questions. So the first one is, how do you see institutions coming into DeFi? We talked about ETFs at the top end. What kind of trend do you see there? What other ways are they going to be able to more directly participate within these networks? And then secondly, more generally around zero-knowledge technology, what excites you about the different applications you could see? But maybe we start with a kind of institutional stakeholder that's kind of coming into the industry now.
Right. I think for one, the emergence of ETFs and the liquidity coming in to get a lot of the Bitcoins or Ethereum later on, they would still need either custodies or they would have need a lending market or a deposit pool to park it at, so then they can create yield on top of that and to be relatively safe and being able to create capital efficiency out of their holdings. So I do see that there would be more drive from a lot of the institutions coming in for a yield perspective. Previously, 2 years ago, you would see institutions coming on to deposits because the interest rate is a lot higher than off-chain. I think the same thing happens now, but instead of them parking fiat and swapping the stablecoin to deposit, they might just park their digital assets on-chain because it's a lot more higher yield on-chain compared to off-chain. That's one. Two, it's, I think for institutions, the payment side, definitely payment rail is something that crypto has been fundamentally a lot stronger than the traditional sense. To give you a very funny example, I still have my bag of stocks. I just diversified. And then I was just doing a little bit of transactions and I sold a few stocks. And right off the bat, and then because crypto, it's so easy. You sell something and then you just transfer it, withdraw it. And then, okay, I just withdraw it back to my bank account. And then I check my bank account, it's not there. And then I got worried for about 2 hours. And then I got a message saying, oh, because the transaction, it's not completed until 3 days later. Why the 3 days? Oh, it's because the settlement date. Why the settlement date? It's because you need a custody to clear it, and then you need the clearinghouse and everything. And that's how you start to think about, oh, because the traditional infrastructure, it still hinges on a lot of incumbents that they cannot improve anymore. It's 3 days, it's the fastest they can go. But with the payment rail and with how crypto is so trustless, and you won't need a custodian in between to facilitate transactions, it just makes sense for a lot of the cross-border payments and everything to basically migrate on-chain. And when you have payment migrate on-chain, you will have liquidity on-chain. Liquidity on-chain, they would have to be somewhere else, I mean, for yielding purpose or whatnot. So I think lending is just, I mean, right in the intersection of payments, intersection of liquidity, and it's just a space that will have a lot of opportunity and potential to scale in the next, I would say, I can't put in a date, but hopefully in the next 1 to 3 years.
Yeah, and I've heard this argument made before, actually. It's a compelling one, which is actually the more institutions have exposure to the asset class, I mean, they are mandated to drive capital efficiency, to drive yield for shareholders in a way that a DeFi trader isn't, right? You know, they're just doing it because they want to do it, or they have the time, the capacity, or the interest. So I think, you know, these large institutions mandated to improve yield, efficiency, and everything else only speaks to the strength, the growing strength of DeFi. So it's interesting to hear you say that. And then more generally, you know, what excites you about ZK, both within DeFi and beyond?
Sure. One thing that I'm very excited about is what we are using zero knowledge proof and layer 2 for. It's the scalability of a component of it, meaning basically we're just bunching a lot of transactions, prove it, and then only the proof get sent to layer 1 to get executed. So it's basically kind of like a zip file in a very simplified example of it. But that's not all of it. I mean, right now you start to see different innovations coming up. Startnet, it's also introducing this, where they have different choices of data availability. A lot of the gas cost, it's basically being consumed by the data itself, about 90 to 95% of it. So when you have different data availability choice for different layers, whether that be layer 2, or if you have large enough or a high enough customized transactions that you want to do execute, you can create your own layer 3. And basically what happened is you will be able to have your own data availability layer to control and to safekeep these data. So it's not actually a privacy preserving or privacy screening component, but it's actually helping you to create a quasi privacy where if, for example, you need to look into the data, it's still there, but you just don't need to show it to everyone that's not within, let's say, your access to layer 3 or your custom layer. So I think that's really powerful for a lot of more larger transactions, volume, or institutional uses.
Okay, well, look, thanks, Brian, for coming on and sharing your insights. I think your perspectives on both institutional adoption, innovation that's happening in ZK, but also just a Web3 founder trying to navigate the space and make tough decisions on a daily basis. I know a lot of other founders are going to really value that. So thanks so much for coming on.
No, thank you. Thank you, Jamie. Thank you for the opportunity.